Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Unlike a funnel, say, you may use in your kitchen or under the hood of your car, not everything makes it through the funnel at the Iowa State House. Joining us to talk about some of the bills that did and didn't pass through the official, it's a self-imposed funnel, a hurdle for the legislation this session, this week. James Lynch covers politics and government in eastern Iowa and the Iowa legislature for the Gazette. James, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back, Ben.
Let's talk about those that did not make it. There are many, but one of them we'd talked about a lot on this program was that proposed tenure ban for professors at Iowa's public universities. Remind us what that was.
This is a bill that would have eliminated tenure for professors at the Regents Universities, University of Iowa, Iowa State, and University of Northern Iowa. And I guess in a way you might just call this a talker, and maybe backers didn't really intend for it to pass. Representative Steve Holt told me that he wanted to start a discussion, and he said the bill certainly did. So he thinks some of the concerns he has are being addressed in other bills that the legislature has moved on related to free speech and divisive concepts used in diversity training, such as critical race theory. So he thinks it started the conversation, and he seems satisfied with that.
Mm-hmm. And this was really made some news, I think even national news, because it would have made Iowa the only state to ban tenure, and there were some real worried business implications for attracting people to Iowa if that had gone through. Anyway, let's move on to another ban that didn't make it through. We've talked about it for years. There was a proposed ban on traffic cameras that met a dead end there.
Again, it died in the legislature, and I'm not sure that this is the last time we'll talk about it. It could come back in the future years. But, yeah, the ban to remove nearly all the automated traffic enforcement cameras was a funnel victim. It would have carved out an exception for that S-curve on 380 through Cedar Rapids. But Senator Bradzon said that the fast pace of the legislature this year, they're trying to get things done before there's a COVID outbreak or something like that would interrupt proceedings like it did last year. And he said there just wasn't time enough to work through this bill, and so he's dropped it for the year. It also ran into an obstacle that Republicans had made a big deal out of defunding the police, and some people were arguing that if you take away the revenue from the traffic cameras, most of that went to public safety and law enforcement, so that would in effect be defunding the police.
Mm-hmm. Also, disappointment, I guess, for drivers who are aggravated by slower drivers on our highways who sort of camp out on the left lane of a divided highway. That didn't go through. There was a proposal to do what there?
It would have added a penalty for people who camp or loiter in the left lane, blocking faster moving traffic from getting around them. This is, I think, probably the third year, at least, that bill has been introduced, and it just never seems to gain critical mass, I guess you would say. There's some support for it, but it just doesn't seem to be a priority with members of the legislature, and again, it died in the funnel.
Mm-hmm. James, let's talk about, of course, there are dozens that did die in the funnel. Let's talk about those that are still alive. Broadband has been a big issue also because this is a week when that huge federal infrastructure proposal was made by the president. What's going on with our state house and broadband?
Well, the House unanimously passed a bill this week that establishes a state grant program for companies that extend broadband to areas, underserved areas of Iowa. The sponsor, Ray Sorensen, said that the idea is that everybody in Iowa, no matter where you live, will be able to conduct Zoom meetings, connect with your doctor or health provider, stream games and movies, and connect farm machinery. This bill had no money in it. This was just a policy bill. The money will come in an appropriation later, legislative leaders say. And remember that Governor, I almost said Governor Branstad, wow, Governor Reynolds wants to go big on broadband. She's calling for $450 million over 3 years. Talk around the Capitol is that it might be closer to $100 million a year, but those appropriations will be coming in a later package.
Mm-hmm. So this has bipartisan support?
Yeah, yeah. I think there will probably be bipartisan support for the funding, although definitely there will be some people pushing for more funding than lawmakers put into it, I'm guessing.
Okay, so that looks like it has a rosy prospects for the rest of the session. Iowa's new election law, which was signed by the governor in early March, also has a sort of a political dimension in national terms, but something's been going on there. Lawmakers want some changes in this measure of this law that's already been passed.
Right. They passed an election law that shortened the time for early voting and limited to one drop box per county, addressed satellite voting. But the House moved a bill this week that they said they probably will amend to make some changes in a few areas of that bill. For example, the bill as passed and signed into law says that a voter must return and submit their own absentee ballot. Now, in some cases, a caretaker could, and the Republicans are saying they want to tweak that so that if you're unable to deliver your own ballot to the county auditor, a family member or caretaker might be able to deliver that. And there were some other areas that they wanted to go into, like they said, tweak, not major changes to what they passed earlier this year, but to make it somewhat more palatable to folks who had opposed the earlier bill. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. This has gotten a lot of attention. President Biden referred to the election laws passed in Georgia and Iowa as Jim Crow 2.0, apparently not realizing that it's easier to vote in Iowa than it is in Delaware, where he lives.
So is it really that pressure, that national conversation being put on that sort of Jim Crow list, so to speak, by the president that pressurized Republicans to make some changes here?
I don't think so, Ben. I think it's more that in the debate on the bill that they passed, some people brought up, they used this term caretaker and caregiver, and somebody pointed out that these are terms that are actually defined elsewhere in Iowa law. And so using those terms, they're not interchangeable, and they actually have legal implications. And so they want to go back and sort of bring those terms into balance with the rest of Iowa code. And I don't think that the people who put the bill together realized that those are terms legally defined. Mm-hmm. And there was another change they wanted to make regarding satellite voting, giving auditors some authority to reject requests if they're duplicative or would be, in their judgment, too costly to set up a satellite voting center. So they give them a little bit more leeway on that. But I don't get the impression that it was the national pressure that motivated them.
Mm-hmm. So Republicans at a state level not worried about political fallout?
They don't seem to be.
Okay. Let's talk about the fallout from this long-standing battle in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District. On Wednesday, Democrat Rita Hart dropped her challenge of the historically close outcome in Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, some 400,000 votes cast in the 2nd District in Iowa. The decision in favor of Marionette Miller Meeks decided by 6 votes. How much of a surprise was it to you that Rita Hart dropped out this week?
Certainly the timing was a surprise. It just sort of like happened, and there weren't any indications that, you know, oh, maybe she's going to withdraw her petition. But there were a number of indications that Democrats especially those who thought they might be vulnerable in 2022, were reluctant to overturn election results, state-certified election results. Republicans were really pushing that message and using it to raise funds. It was becoming clear that this wasn't working for Democrats. So I guess, in a way, we shouldn't be surprised, but yeah, the timing was a surprise coming this week. It's interesting, too, Ben. I covered a GOP fundraiser last night where Miller Meeks spoke. She got the rock star treatment from the Republican Party and the folks there, but she got very emotional as she talked about this. And you know, she was provisionally seated, and now she's officially seated as a member of Congress. She kind of choked up as she talked about it, but she also was very defiant, saying that she was in a staring contest with Nancy Pelosi, and Pelosi blinked. So I'm sure that won't endear her to the Speaker of the House. But she, like I said, she got the rock star treatment.
Interesting. Thank you so much. James Lynch covers politics, government, and the Iowa legislature for the Gazette. Always nice to talk with you. Thank you, James.
You bet. Thanks, Ben.
Glad you're along on this pre-Easter weekend edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. April 2nd, and that means we're moving closer to the prime window for planting corn and soybeans. Let's get a perspective on this growing season from Chad Hart, professor of economics and grain market specialist at Iowa State University. Chad, welcome back to the program.
It's my pleasure to be with you today.
I understand a new USDA report is just out. Take us through some of the highlights.
Certainly. Every end of March, USDA does a survey of farmers around the country, surveying them as to what they're going to plant this year, how many acres are going to be out there. And so we got that report here at the end of March. And what it sort of showed us is that as we look nationwide, we're planting a little more corn and a little more soybeans across the country.
Mm-hmm. And what are some other factors? What we had, of course, in 2020, the storm damage from the derecho, many fields impacted that way. Does that carry over into this spring planting? If so, how?
It definitely has an impact, especially here as we're looking at eastern Iowa, where you know we had the most damage from that derecho. The biggest impact here would be from the idea of a volunteer corn plant. So if you think about those corn plants that got flattened during the derecho, some of those grains, you know, fell back into the soil, reseeded, and can come back up this year. The problem with that is that those plants weren't planted by us, and so don't fit the pattern of what we're going to plant within those fields. And any plant that you don't want exactly where you want it essentially becomes a weed. And so you're seeing these farmers having to manage this year's plantings and this year's crops based upon some of the damage that they suffered from last year's crop.
Mm-hmm. Does that derecho damage carrying over impact how many acres of beans or corn are planted?
It definitely would. The more likely case that's happening here is that we will see farmers, and the data sort of shows this, Iowa producers are going to plant a little less corn this year, but plant more soybeans this year. And it's likely that a lot of those areas in the derecho that were corn last year would be soybeans this year because it's a little bit easier to manage that volunteer corn problem with soybeans in that field as opposed to another crop of corn.
Myself as a city dweller was thinking about all that snow we had piled up in some parts of Iowa just a few weeks ago in February especially, and dreading perhaps a quick snow melt with some rains in the spring to complicate many lives, especially farmers' lives. How are soil conditions out there? Are there any really wet fields out there?
There may be a few, but for the most part, we're more worried about the dryness in the soils. Mm. When you think about, again, going back to last year, not only did we have the derecho, but we had the drought. And that drought has basically stuck with us as we've moved here into 2021. As you look at the latest drought monitor, northern and western Iowa is where we face the driest conditions. But that's also, as you look at the nation, we've got drought-type conditions over nearly half the country right now. And so that is the big concern as we approach planting right now would be those dry soils are going to give us the opportunity to plant, but it also brings up concerns about how much production we might be able to see from those plantings.
What about prices and demand for corn and soybeans, not only domestically, but abroad?
Well, what we've seen on the price side is a phenomenal recovery over the past 6-7 months, being driven by very strong international demand for agricultural products. Over the past 6 months, we've seen corn exports reach to near record levels. We're looking at soybeans basically at record levels in terms of those export sales. We've also seen very strong domestic usage of corn and soybeans, so our livestock industries have continued to produce at record to near record levels. And so for the most part, that demand structure, at least for crop agriculture, has been very robust, even in the face of the COVID pandemic.
Okay, thank you very much for the update in this start of the planting season. Chad Hart, Professor of Economics and Grain Market Specialist at Iowa State University. Chad, thank you, and have a wonderful Easter weekend.
Thank you, you too.
Before the break, well, let's talk about Monday. Monday, of course, a milestone in our state's COVID vaccination campaign. Here to tell us about it, IPR health reporter Natalie Krebs. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Ben.
Monday, April 5th. I should have a drum roll. What's happening?
Yeah, April 5th. This Monday's a really big day. This is when Iowa will open up vaccine eligibility to anyone 16 or older. That's the group that have been approved by the FDA to be able to get the COVID-19 vaccine. So finally, you know, anyone who wants the vaccine and is FDA approved to get one can get one now.
Okay. So are there any messages for those seeking an appointment who haven't been able to have an appointment so far because of the because it hasn't been open to their age group?
Right. Just like, you know, I sound like a broken record, but once again, we have the same issue that we've had during this whole vaccine rollout, which is that, you know, supply or demand is going to far exceed supply. So, you know, Governor Reynolds, public health officials have been warning people it might be a little bit before you can get an appointment. You know, you might just have to be patient, but more doses are coming, so more appointments are going to be available.
Some Iowans, of course, have said through polls they don't want to get vaccinated. According to a Des Moines Register poll, I think you cited in your reporting released last month, 27% of Iowans say they do not plan to get the vaccine, sort of matching national numbers. I wonder, since then, do we see confidence in vaccination increasing?
Yeah, so polling numbers have also indicated that vaccine confidence is increasing, you know, as compared to some of the polls that happened last fall before the vaccine was approved. And now, you know, when we've had a number of people, millions of people vaccinated across the U.S. So that is something I know there are a lot of activists out in the community. I just did a story on this that are really working to increase vaccine confidence for groups that are more hesitant. This includes the Black community, the Latino community. And as that Iowa poll that you just cited said last month, people are citing a political divide. A lot of people who identify as Republicans are citing some vaccine hesitancy as well.
Right. And Iowa Republicans, 41% of Iowa Republicans say they're not planning on getting a shot, according to that poll last month. That's amazing. Talk about not only the groups. We have our Black community, Latino community, and Republicans. What are some of the reasons, a little bit more about the reasons that people are not getting this vaccine? Because it's not, unless you are believing conspiracy theories, you are believing in the wrong science. It's not really based on science, or is it?
Yeah, there's a whole variety of reasons why people are hesitant about the vaccine. You know, the Black community has experienced a lot of historical trauma with medicine. So, you know, they're sort of understandably very reluctant about a new vaccine like this. People have told me the Latino community is everything from, you know, just fears of people who might be undocumented, worried about possibly getting deported when they go get the vaccine, to not having enough vaccine information available in Spanish in Iowa. And then Republicans as well have cited some hesitancy as well around the vaccine. Some experts I've spoken to said that, you know, might relate back to Trump and back to the era when he was so decisive about this pandemic.
Right. And talk a little bit more about the efforts to raise awareness about vaccine safety and the importance of getting that herd immunity. You reported on this mass COVID vaccination clinic at a Baptist church in Des Moines. What was that like?
Yeah, this was a huge event that happened last Saturday. And, you know, Governor Reynolds spoke about this in our press conference both this week and the week before. It was a clinic set up in a Baptist church here in Des Moines. It was specifically targeting minority communities. It was sort of set up in a church that has a big Black attendance as a safe space, as a place that, you know, would really be comfortable for them to get the vaccine as opposed to, you know, going to a health clinic. And it's efforts like these that are being made to sort of make people feel more comfortable about getting the vaccine and to get information out. In my story, I spoke to experts who basically said it's really important that, you know, as leaders of these communities that are more hesitant, these groups that are more hesitant need to be the ones that are able to kind of spread the message about vaccine safety.
Mm-hmm. And news even from this morning, new from the CDC, Americans who are fully vaccinated can travel, according to the CDC, at low risk to themselves, both here in the U.S. and internationally. So that's good, but we have to remain vigilant, right?
Right. So, yeah, as this news comes, we're also seeing reports of an increased number of hospitalizations and cases across the country, including here in Iowa. Hospitalizations are now north of 200. They've been floating around that for a while. So there are a lot of unvaccinated people out there. So, you know, it just reminds us we really still need to follow these public health mitigation strategies. I mean, everyone needs to be wearing a mask in public. We need to be social distancing. It's still very easy to see another wave of COVID infections.
We hope that will not happen, of course. IPR health reporter Natalie Krebs, thank you for the update.
Thank you, Ben.
When we come back after a short break, Tim Walsh, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, he'll take us back to, well, the 1800s, even the late 1700s, to talk about the immigration debate that has happened in previous generations. Who is let in and who is kept out? That's when we continue on this Friday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
The Iowa legislature is in session.
Let's just go around. We got a lot of people.
There are proposals for constitutional amendments, education, taxes, the budget, and many policy bills.
So what needs to be fixed?
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, is following the session.
I want to thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
I'm John Pemble. Subscribe to the podcast or hear Under the Golden Dome on our website, iowapublicradio.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We are, of course, known as a nation of immigrants. But at the same time, the U.S. has always had an ambivalent attitude toward immigration, those who are let in and those who are kept out. This half hour, some historical perspective on the current immigration debate. Joining us for the half hour, Tim Walsh, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Welcome back to the program, Tim.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
Some fascinating discussions here as you take us back over 200 years in history, in our country's history. We'll get up to the 20th century and even into the 21st century with history. Funny to talk about the 21st century being history, but it is, in fact, Tim, as we realize it. Let's go back to the earliest days of our republic when immigration first became an issue and this ambivalence appeared.
Yeah, that's what I think surprises most people, is that an issue that we talk about today as the Biden border crisis really has its roots in the 1790s, when the country was really trying to decide who we were when we say we the people. I mean, we wanted to let people in because we had lots of land that was needed to be settled. We had infrastructure that needed to be built. We had space for all kinds of people. But we also wanted to say, no, wait a minute, we want to make sure that the people we have are propertied, are healthy, are people of good character, and so forth. And so we were constantly passing laws, immigration laws, to try to regulate who was going to come in, how many years they had to stay before they could become a citizen, and the whole process then of settlement. And as the country grew and became more dynamic and more people were attracted, there was more tension. It was also true that there was a push, that is, particularly European immigrants were being pushed out of their country by political unrest and a lack of employment and other things. And, of course, America was attractive. So the symbol of the Statue of Liberty, which, of course, the statue is given to us by France, but in many ways it captures what people thought of America as this light beacon attracting people to this country. But it's, as I say, it's always been a point of tension in the 19th century, and we go up and down and up and down as far as who we invite. I'm always reminded of a speech that Franklin Roosevelt gave to the Daughters of the American Revolution, and he started out his speech by saying, "Fellow immigrants." Yeah. We're all immigrants, aren't we? Except for indigenous people, the Native Americans.
Right, and in our modern conversation about this, we tend to lump sort of European immigrants in one class, Italians and Germans and what have you, into one class. But in earlier generations, they were distinct groups, and there were some that were more valued than others, right?
Absolutely. In fact, the ideal among the elites who controlled the country was to have people who were white, Anglo-Saxon, male Protestants. And to the extent to which you varied from those qualities, so to speak, it made you less desirable. And so even the Irish and the Italians and the Greeks, who we think of as Caucasian today, were seen as separate races. And there was a book at the turn of the 20th century, actually 1916, by a man named Madison Grant, terrific name. It was called The Passing of the Great Race. And he said, America's becoming mongrelized. We have to do something to control immigration from all these Jews and Greeks and Italians and Germans and Irish. And so there's a push, and in 1924, we have a very strict quota system set up that favored Northern Europeans, and particularly Northern European Protestants, coming into the country. And that law essentially controlled the flow of immigration into the country until about 1965, in fact, 1965, when it was revised and opened. And all of this is just, in effect, controlling the whole question of quotas for what we would consider European nations. The Chinese were largely, and Asians, frankly, were largely excluded from immigration after 1882. So we've had kind of a shabby record when it comes to the way we've treated people of color coming into the country through ports of entry. And then when we talk about the southern border, there's been a lot of movement back and forth between Mexico and the western United States before the whole question of building a border wall or controlling immigration from the south.
I want to come back to the southern border because we have some audio about that. But first of all, because of the anti-Asian racism, the sentiments that we've had in our news lately, talk a little bit more about that. That goes back to the 1800s. Of course, Asian immigrants, a critical part of building this country.
Oh, without question. The Asians and the Central Pacific Railroad and the Irish and the Union Pacific Railroad are the ones who basically linked the eastern and western parts of the country by building the Transcontinental Railroad. But once the Chinese had finished this Herculean task, they became less and less valuable, and there was greater hostility, particularly in California, toward the Chinese. And so they were largely, there's the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, and so the Chinese essentially were kept out of the country for not a century, but for about 80 years. And then, of course, there's the hostility that we showed toward the Japanese during World War II. There has been a persistent hostility toward Asian and Pacific Islanders. And, of course, we've seen it in violence in recent days. But as I say, it goes back to the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. So when we get into the early 20th century, before we talk about the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st, what are some mile markers there in our immigration history?
Well, certainly what we the 1924 Act, which is something I encourage people, Immigration Restriction Act, I think it's the Johnson-Reed Act, set these very specific tight quotas that basically restricted the numbers of people coming in. And what's so amazing for legislation, given how much we tinker, it's the fact that it lasted that long until 1965. With 65, we begin to open up. We begin to not only allow immigration from other nations and other parts of the world, but we also then become more conscious of asylum seekers and basically helping to maintain and reestablish families. The sort of you hear this phrase so often, chain migration. So the idea is that one person is able to establish themselves here and they become citizens, and mm-hmm. then they bring their spouse or children and then their parents and so forth. And this is something that concerned President Trump and others, that somehow we were creating this unnecessary pipeline of people coming into the country. A lot of it depends on the American people's attitude toward particular countries and racial groups, but also the question of how the economy is doing. Are there jobs and opportunity? There was an effort to basically repatriate people in the early days of the Great Depression because the jobs weren't there, and so we sent tens of thousands of Hispanic people back to Mexico and other countries to the south because we just didn't have jobs available.
Mm-hmm. If you just go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and we've seen that ebb and flow throughout time. So as the country is growing, as we had land available, as we had jobs, I mean, a lot of construction jobs. You know, if we have a big infrastructure bill, there's going to be a lot of construction work, and there's going to be a lot of need for workers. And so the question then is, do you expand your guest worker program? And, of course, there are a lot of undocumented people who are here in the country who've been here for a decade or more. Finding a way to work, they contribute substantially. I know that a lot of people don't think that, and I know President Trump has attacked them, but they contribute substantially more to the country than they draw in terms of benefits or taxes or what have you.
If you've just joined us, presidential historian, Tim Walsh, Director of Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, is with us this half hour, talking about the history of immigration restriction. We've had it as a contentious issue now for many, many years. So we're getting a bit of a historical footing here from Tim. I wanted to talk a little bit more about, well, the late 20th century on into the current times. You've mentioned Trump a couple of times. He's a standout here. But let's just review where we were not too long ago, relatively speaking, in our histories, the history of our country. I want to play a couple of clips here, Tim. We know mm-hmm. build the wall as the Republican mantra from our most recent campaigns, but it wasn't always the way Republicans viewed things. Let's go back to 1980, for instance. We'll hear a couple of clips from a debate, a presidential debate, GOP presidential debate in Houston, where the presidential hopeful and future president George H.W. Bush was asked by an audience member if children in the country illegally should be allowed to attend U.S. public schools. And he gave this impassioned response.
The problem has to be solved. The problem has to be solved. Because as we have kind of made illegal some kinds of labor that I'd like to see legal, we're doing two things. We're creating a whole society of really honorable, decent, family-loving people that are in violation of the law. And secondly, we're exacerbating relations with Mexico. If they're living here, I don't want to see a whole thing of 6- and 8-year-old kids being made, you know, one totally uneducated and made to feel that they're living with outside the law. Let's address ourselves to the fundamentals. These are good people, strong people. Part of my family is a Mexican.
Okay, in that same 1980 debate, Ronald Reagan added to Bush's answer by saying the country needed a better understanding and relationship with our neighboring country to the south.
I think the time has come that the United States and our neighbors, particularly our neighbor to the south,
should have a better understanding and a better relationship than we've ever had. And I think that we haven't been sensitive enough to our size and our power. They have a problem of 40 to 50% unemployment. Now, this cannot continue without the possibility arising with regard to that other country that we talked about, of Cuba and what it is stirring up, of the possibility of trouble below the border, and we could have a very hostile and strange neighbor on our border. Rather than making them or talking about putting up a fence, why don't we work out some recognition of our mutual problems, make it possible for them to come here legally with a work permit, and then while they're working and earning here, they pay taxes here. And when they want to go back, they can go back and they can cross and open the border both ways by understanding their problems. This is the only safety valve right now they have with that unemployment that probably keeps the lid from blowing off down there. And I think we could have a fine relationship, and it would solve the problem you mentioned also.
Okay, then candidate Ronald Reagan in 1980, and before Tim, you jump in here and connect the dots for us, that was some 40 years ago. We know the rhetoric of Donald Trump. In fact, let's remind ourselves of the rhetoric of Donald Trump as regard our immigration policy.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Without borders, we do not have a country, folks.
I'm going to cut off federal funding to sanctuary cities.
We will restore the civil rights of African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and all Americans by ending illegal immigration. And yes, we will build the wall.
We will deport all criminal illegal immigrants. You have a lot of people that are walking around. Suspend the Syrian refugee program and keep radical Islamic terrorists the hell out of our country. Extreme vetting. Extreme. Oh, it's going to be extreme.
A few samples of the most memorable lines of candidate and then President Trump. I'm leaving it up to you now, Tim, to take us through those 40 years. We see also in those quotes, a transformation of the Republican Party in terms of immigration policy. Explain what's going on in those 40 years that we get a very compassionate view, a worried view looking to our southern border, all the way up to what we just heard from Donald Trump.
Well, it is, and it's very dramatic. It occurred to me when I was listening to President Reagan and President, then Vice President Bush, or I suppose they were both candidates at the time, you know, from their mouths to Joe Biden's ear, it almost seems as if the position that Ronald Reagan and George Bush as candidates were taking in 1980 is essentially the core program of what the Democrats have right now. So what's happened to some extent is because of Donald Trump's very strong and passionate attack on immigration, particularly from the South, and the call to build a wall, you have people who once saw themselves as conservative Republicans taking a position of compassion and compassionate conservatism appearing to be liberal or more tolerant of people coming over the wall. I think evident to anybody who studies the issue, and that was true, quite frankly, going back to the 19th century up to the present, that because of the push of circumstances, whether it's political hostility or it's economic or whatever, people from other countries are going to do their every possible effort to get into this country, even to the point, as we saw the last couple of days, of these coyotes dropping children over the wall because they know the United States will care for children. We are compassionate, and we have always had a component going back to the 80s and actually the Hmong people who came here to Iowa and so forth, 70s and 80s, of being compassionate to asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. And so that seems to be now a point of real tension. How compassionate should we be to those people from the South, particularly from Central America, as they try to push forward? And I just don't think the notion of a wall, I know that it becomes a political issue, but the notion of a wall is going to prevent them from finding a way to get here.
Of course, long sought is a comprehensive immigration reform policy, bipartisan. This was something that the former President Obama was working toward. Let's listen to him talk an excerpt of his speech in 2015, June of 2015, and you can tell us a little bit more about the context here and what this represents. Former President Barack Obama addressing the nation, calling for, urging Congress to vote on immigration reform.
We're a nation of immigrants. It's a source of our strength and something we can all take pride in. Of course, we can't just celebrate this heritage. We have to defend it by fixing our broken immigration system. Nearly 2 years ago, Democrats and Republicans in the Senate came together to do that. They passed a common sense bill to secure our border, get rid of backlogs, and give undocumented immigrants who are already living here a pathway to citizenship if they paid a fine, paid their taxes, and went to the back of the line. But for nearly 2 years, Republican leaders in the House have refused to even allow a vote on it. That's why, in the meantime, I'm going to keep doing everything I can to make our immigration system more just and more fair.
Okay, so it was during the Obama presidency that the parties came together almost. It passed one chamber, but not the other, Tim?
Yes, I mean, that we seem to go back and forth. And really going back to 2005, there have been these congressional efforts to find some sort of practical way to address the fact that we had 11 million people who were hardworking, largely law-abiding people in this country who we needed to address. They were undocumented. And in some cases, they were being abused because they didn't have the documentation to protect themselves. And then the whole question, too, the phrase, we heard this over and over again, DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. These are people, young children who came to this country, and this is the only country they know, and they speak English, and they've gone through high school. Many of them have been through the military, but they're not citizens, because they were born in Mexico or someplace else. So the issue isn't going to go away. Now, the high point of this undocumented immigration was 2007. It's been getting lower each year, but as the numbers have lowered, the rhetoric seems to have been exacerbated. And so here we are again, with the Biden border crisis, which was a Trump border crisis, and before that an Obama border crisis.
Right.
Take your choice. I'm sure the next president will also have a border crisis. And again, we all need to remember many of our ancestors actually snuck across the border through Canada if they'd come from a British country or from one of the Hispanic countries to the south, from Mexico or so forth. And you could live a life here in this country in the 19th century before we needed lots of documentation. We all didn't have to have photo IDs back in the 19th century.
Right. We have just over a minute left, Tim. I wonder, as a historian, watching the ebbs and flows, studying the ebbs and flows, in this case, of immigration policy over decades, over centuries here in the U.S., does it give you any indication of where we're headed in this country, when we may have a solution that is palpable to the two major parties?
I want to be optimistic, and there's no harm in being optimistic that this friction will eventually find a point of resolution. I think most Americans are big-hearted and want to allow for asylum, but they want to allow it on an orderly basis. If we could find a way to have a common understanding of what the facts are, and not use the issue as a political football, I think we could find a compromise solution. But that seems to be true with many issues in today's world. So it's right. That this is just another element of this multiple points of friction.
Yeah, that is a big if we would exist.
Better to be optimistic than to be dystopian or pessimistic that we're never going to find a resolution. But I don't think that there's any simple solution to this. The notion of a wall, and we've had repeated efforts to build walls throughout history, and yeah, people who are determined to get here will swim across the Gulf of Mexico if they have to. I mean,
right,
they're going to find a way because they're being pushed out of the country, where they were born.
Tim Walsh, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, thank you for joining us and putting our current immigration debate in historical perspective. Tim, thanks again.
Thanks, Ben.
Well, coming up Monday on the program, we'll talk about the recent casualties of the current legislative session, meaning the bills that didn't make it. I'll have a slew of Iowa State House journalists as guests. That's on Monday. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
If you own a business or run an organization, consider using IPR as part of your marketing strategy. Let us show you how to reach our loyal radio audience, advertise on our digital platforms, and even sponsor your favorite podcast. Spread the word about your business and support IPR at the same time. It's a win-win. Learn more at iowapublicradio.org/sponsors.